Yes, I have to tell you, I am enjoying this presidential campaign season because this is the first presidential race since the year 2000 that I have not been under indictment. I was held under indictment from March of 2004 until January 15th, 2009, 5 days before President Obama was inaugurated. And from the time of my release from Carswell Prison right up until the election, they fought to get me back in prison. I'll tell you tonight how they pulled every dirty trick in the book. I was even forced to appear in court without an attorney present, fighting against the U.S. attorneys to stop a bail revocation. It was the only day that my attorney could not appear in court, and he said he protested vigorously. He was a very effective counsel, but we had this is about as dirty a case as you will ever hear, and I'll tell you about it tonight. I guess you could call this the secret confessions of a 9/11 whistleblower, but in fact, every American activist and intellectual, whatever your political stripe, it doesn't matter anymore. The Patriot Act has expanded the definition of sedition to say that you don't have to be engaged in violent activities. You don't have to be thinking violent thoughts. You don't have to speak violent words. If your actions, your ideas pose a challenge to the powers that be who are in control of the government, and they might, a Congress member, your local Congress member might lose office. He might lose that election because you're too good at what you're doing. You are now subject to this. And you think I'm kidding, and I am not kidding you. I only wish that I was. It's worth noting as we start this that I was the second non-Arab American indicted on the Patriot Act after Jose Padilla. While I was under indictment, however, the Maryland State Police, where I live to this day, used the Patriot Act to go after the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, which supports wind power, recycling, solar energy. They went after the PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. They went after the DC Anti-War Network, claiming that they were white supremacists because it just happened that they were a bunch of white college kids. So they were labeled, because it just happened to be a group of college kids, they were labeled as a white, potential white supremacist group. I mean, crazy. Amnesty International was targeted on the Patriot Act because they said they might be guilty of civil rights violations. Amnesty International might be guilty of espousing civil rights violations. Okay. It's craziness. I will tell you that on the morning of my arrest, the dogs never barked at my house. I have little dachshunds who are very yappy. And the feds snuck up on us so quietly, so stealthily. We were minding our own business. I was getting up to make coffee. And I had never broken the law in my life. And to this day, I don't believe I ever have. I have had differences with our government, but I had worked in anti-terrorism for a decade. I thought of myself, and I realize that a lot of people here don't like the CIA, and you probably don't like the kinds of things. I've never done rendition or any kind of waterboarding or anything like that. But I realize you guys don't like the CIA. I get that. But I had always been thought of myself as one of the good guys. Okay? I gave advance warning about the 93 World Trade Center attack, advance warning about the bombing of the USS Cole. I did the Lockerbie negotiations with Libya. I did the weapons inspections talks with Iraq. I did one of the first investigations of Osama bin Laden before the Dar es Salaam Nairobi bombings. My bona fides in anti-terrorism were superior. My CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, had been in Lebanon during the 1980s, And he was involved in the hostage rescue of Terry Anderson and Terry Waite. And he had infiltrated Hezbollah and the heroin trafficking out of the Bekaa Valley, which was financing the hostages crisis and causing all these problems. My other defense intelligence handler had outed Oliver North. He was not with Oliver North. He exposed Oliver North. And he worked on the Project for Military Procurement, which exposed the $10,000 toilet seats and the $5,000 screws. So we had a history. There is a tradition in the intelligence community that you defend America, you're supposed to defend America. And it's supposed to be a patriotic thing to protect the community from this sort of corruption. And that's always what we were raised to believe. And so when I gave advance warning about 9/11, and the people of America wanted to hear the truth, I thought you actually might have a right to know what actually happened. The government did not see it that way. They did not. I became public enemy number one. Me and Osama bin Laden were essentially right up there in the same category. I was almost categorized as an enemy non-combatant. And here I had devoted my life to working against violence. On the morning of my arrest, when the feds snuck up on my house, when they were standing on my porch demanding to come into my house, they said, open the door. And I had barricaded the front door because my house, the front door of my house had mysteriously broken 3 weeks before. As I had suspected for some time and had been telling friends, I was in fact subjected to several warrantless searches. It used to be before the Patriot Act that a grand jury would only be convened if you actually had evidence of a crime. They wouldn't waste their time unless there was some proof that you actually did something wrong. Nowadays, under the Patriot Act, if they want to get you, they convene the grand jury first, and then they begin looking for something to hang you with. And of course, any law professor will tell you that if you look hard enough somewhere, you're going to find something against somebody. That you can always build a case against somebody in some way. And apparently in the Southern District of New York, they have a little game that they play where they throw out names of famous people, like Mother Teresa or, I guess, Susan Lindauer, and say, how can we hang this person? How could we find a crime to throw at this person and get them thrown in jail? And they sit around and drink beer and pizza and talk about how they can screw ordinary Americans. And that's what they did to me. But the Patriot Act, so they couldn't open the door. I said, they said, if you don't open the door, we're going to break it down. I said, you already broke it. You're going to break it again? And they did not think that was funny. And when they came in through a side door and they told me that I was being indicted on the Patriot Act, I didn't think it was funny either. I was like, why? How did? I mean, I was shocked and stunned, and I was like, why? How can you do this? How could you possibly rationalize attacking me? I had asked to testify. I have read, the beauty of the Patriot Act is that they have phone records of everything. They had captured 28,000 phone records, 8,000 emails, hundreds of faxes that I'd sent to members of Congress before the Iraqi war, telling members of Congress, under no circumstances should you go into Iraq. There will be no weapons of mass destruction. There's a peace option on the table, people. We can solve every problem that you have identified without firing a shot. Every single item on the agenda was resolvable. Iraq agreed to, sorry, I'm in a church. I'm going to try to hold my swearing down. I do have a problem with that. I really do. And if I swear, I apologize. But it really makes me angry. The Patriot Act is 7,000 pages, as most of you know, that was passed, that was pulled out of a drawer after 9/11, mysteriously intact. Okay, it was already made, and it mirrors thousands of pages mirror the Soviet criminal code that established the KGB, the Soviet Gulag system under Joseph Stalin. Okay? Neighbors are, it allows things that you can't even imagine in the United States of America. Secret charges, secret evidence, secret grand jury testimony. By that I mean, we were never, I had two public defenders, I have two attorneys. One, the first was a public defender because I couldn't afford a $200,000 defense or $300,000 defense. This was going to be astronomical, so I had to have a public defender. He didn't know what to do. And he had a very low-level aptitude. He had a very standard aptitude. He just had no specialty. He had no capability to do this case. My second attorney was, after prison, was named Brian Shaughnessy, and a superior attorney. One of the best, he's done many CIA cases, he's a former federal prosecutor. He had a top secret security clearance for most of his career. He worked in the court of Judge John Sirica. You remember John Sirica, who did Watergate? Brian Shaughnessy was the top prosecutor assigned to Judge Sirica's court. Neither one of these individuals, the low-level public defender or the supreme high-flying attorney who helped to overturn the sentencing guidelines. If any of you are from Harvard Law, you'll know how the sentencing guidelines were overturned. Brian Shaughnessy helped to do that. Neither one of these attorneys, the best of the best of the best, was ever allowed to know what I was accused of doing. They were never allowed to see the evidence that a crime even occurred. They were not allowed to know what the crime consisted of. What activity was it? What did this woman do? Oh, we can't tell you that. Oh, no, we can't tell you that. We do know that, because I know what I was doing in that time period, that I was possibly accused of receiving a book on depleted uranium and cancer rates in Iraqi children. And this book would have exposed, I suppose, the threats to American soldiers from long-term exposure to this hideous depleted uranium, which has caused grotesque defects in Baghdad. And because they had a health security risk, because we can't really tell our soldiers what we're doing to them, this was considered a classified item. But I should go to prison for 5 years because I got a book? Wouldn't you think if there was a if you were on a jury and you heard that there was a classified evidence against someone, wouldn't you presume it was like something really big? Something really, she must have done something really, really, really bad. No. Mm-mm. Because they can exaggerate, they can falsify, they use the secret evidence to hide the paucity of evidence against you. They make it, it casts this big shadow over this, it's like one tiny little thing that creates this huge shadow across the room. And the other thing was that the other secret charge, we believe, was that the Iraqi government wanted to give the Bush administration the Bush campaign, not the Bush administration, the Bush campaign in the first election, several hundred thousand dollars in campaign contributions, which I immediately reported to my defense intelligence handler and stopped from happening. In other words, the Iraqis wanted to do it. I immediately reported it to the CIA and defense intelligence, and we stopped the crime from occurring because it would have been catastrophic to our efforts to get the weapons inspectors back into Iraq. My defense intelligence handler told me that if they ever gave money to the Bush administration, they would have no choice but to bomb them into the Stone Age. There would be no way of ever getting the sanctions off. So I was the one designated to stop that from happening, and they arrested me for it because they didn't want to show that Saddam had been trying to make friends with Iraq. Now, I know you guys are here for 9/11. No. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. Yes. Saddam had been trying to make friends with the U.S. very desperately. And be careful what you wish for, because they kept saying that they Iraq would be a strategic bulwark against Iran, and would be a way of balancing Iran's return to power and rise. And of authority. But I want to shift over to 9/11, because what starts to happen is that from the end of the Clinton administration, talks begin on resuming the weapons inspections and a comprehensive peace framework. And the CIA in reality was working on two paths. The CIA, and it wasn't that the CIA didn't know that Bush wanted to do this, but just like when you see Libya today, and you know that Obama's an idiot who was attacking, is an idiot for attacking Libya, you have factions, you have some factions who say, oh yeah, go get Libya. And then you have other factions saying, wait a minute, that's a really stupid thing to do. So these two parallel tracks are—it's not uncommon. I realize that from your perspective as outsiders, you're used to thinking of the whole intelligence community moving in unison, and that's not what happens. This is very factionalized, and the intelligence community is fighting back and forth and back and forth. I will tell you that a lot of I see a sign out here, you know, oppose NATO support. For Syrian support President Bashar al-Assad, stop U.S.-NATO Zionist war on Syria and Iran. And this gentleman and I had a conversation before the talk. You'd be surprised to know I agree with him. And so do a lot of people in the intelligence community. It's insane what we're doing over there. And a lot of people knew that it would be a disaster to go after Baghdad, especially if we could get such a great sweetheart deal. So we had the following, and I want you to realize, because 9/11, in my opinion, should not be examined in isolation, but it should be looked at in a total perspective of what exactly they were trying to overcome. There was a fabulous peace option on the table, and the peace option included weapons inspections with no conditions, cooperation with anti-terrorism, including an FBI task force that Iraq had authorized to go into Baghdad and make in terrorism investigations and conduct arrests and interview witnesses. And this is before 9/11. They also offered special priority contracts to the United States in oil production, oil equipment purchases, pipeline rebuilding. Iraq's oil infrastructure had been destroyed. And so the United States was going to have the lion's share of all those contracts rebuilding the oil industry in Iraq. You didn't have to go to war. You didn't have to kill a single Iraqi child. You didn't. Not one American soldier had to lose their arm and a leg to go to get that oil. They would have given it to you. They wanted to give it to you. They offered you the Lukoil contract. Okay? They also offered us preferential contracts in telecommunications. That's telephones, satellites, internet. They offered us preferential contracts in healthcare, hospital equipment, pharmaceuticals. That's still something America makes. They offered to buy 1 million American manufactured automobiles every year for 10 years. You know, I got to tell you, if I had been allowed to talk, Do you think George Bush would have got reelected?
He was never elected in the first place.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. But seriously, look at what the Patriot Act was used to do. The Patriot Act was used to guarantee the ignorance of the American people, so that you would be deprived of real factual information that you could use to make an educated decision about, an educated choice about what you want as a lead, from leadership and foreign policy. And in the middle of this, while these talks are going, and the CIA is pushing hard, the CIA was going for everything they could get. And I am, quote, deniable in the sense that the CIA doesn't have to admit that it's all true, but because we have the wiretaps, thanks Patriot Act, because we have the phone emails and we have the phone conversations, which I have them tapes. I have the tapes of the phone conversations. I can prove every single word of this book that I wrote, Extreme Prejudice. And in the middle of this, we have 9/11. Which is more horrific in my mind, and which is already horrific in its own right. It's terrible all by itself in isolation. But it's even more offensive when you realize that why they deliberately constructed it, and it was allowed to happen on one hand, it was made to happen, it was command failure of the most egregious sort, but there was also hands-on manipulation. It was both. It was all of these things. The different factions going at it to different degrees that they were capable of contributing to it. And so you have the CIA on one hand fighting to stop it, and you have the other 15% who are wrecking a wrecking ball. And it's easier to tear things down than it is to build them any day. If you want to have some, you could have five people come in and tear up this room right now and have, the 100 or the 50, 75 of us, and we'd be trying to stop them, and they could just damage the place. And it doesn't take that many people. It probably took a team of 10 to wire the World Trade Center with explosives. But that's what they did. And the reason they did it was they knew that the international loathing of saying they wanted war in Iraq so badly. They wanted war in Afghanistan because they wanted to control the pipeline. They wanted to shift it away from Iran. Okay? And these poor Afghani people, I mean, I don't like the Taliban. I don't like the Taliban. Okay? I don't. But they had nothing to do with this. The Taliban tried to tell us about the 9/11, that Al-Qaeda was planning something before 9/11 happens. Throughout the summer, they kept saying, something's going on. There was 105 reports from the CIA, 105 reports to the Bush administration top echelon throughout the summer of 2001, detailing new developments in the pre-9/11 investigation. Okay? And George Bush refused to take any sort of action. It would have been very easy to stop the 9/11 attack. And I'll tell you what I did. And now I'll tell you my story and how I intersect with that. Because I learned about the 9/11 conspiracy from my CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, in April of 2001. I was summoned to his office. He called me at home. We had regular weekly meetings, and we spoke on the phone every day, and he called me up and he said, Susan, I have a message for you to deliver to the Iraqis in New York, and I want you to come right away and get the message, and I want you to go up to New York as fast as you can. Now, I had been a back channel to the Iraqis since August of 96. I'd been a back channel to Libya since May of 95. So I knew, if there was a message, I knew exactly what to do. This was not new territory for me. Anti-terrorism was not something new for me. I'd been doing it for years. I knew the seriousness of it. We're trained how to execute it. Like if you have a grand policy speech, we know how to break it down into steps so that we can execute a stoppage if we want to. If you want to stop it, you can. It's very easy to do. It's not hard to do. So that's what our team set about doing. In April of 2001, my CIA handler said to me, come over, take this message. We are asking the Iraqi government for any intelligence on airplane hijackings. And we want them to know that if they fail to give us this intelligence and it was discovered later that they possessed it, then we will hit them harder than they've ever been hit before. And I said, oh, okay, I'll deliver the message. I went to New York and I was very polite. The first time, it's very polite. Iraq had already offered to let the FBI come into Baghdad. They were already invited to send an FBI task force into Baghdad. So I said to the diplomats, my friends, I said, you know, hey, please send a cable to Baghdad. Tell them we're looking for this intelligence. And you know, if you get anything, let us know. I went back to Richard. He said, so what did you do? What did they say when you threatened them? And I said, oh, I didn't threaten them. I didn't need to do that. They've always helped us in the past. Iraq was one of our best sources on anti-terrorism for years. Because Saddam recognized that anti-terrorism was something that was a shared value system with the United States. He was very paranoid of Islamic radicals. He was afraid they would destabilize his country under sanctions and take advantage of the dire poverty. And so, you know, he always helped the United States. So if we asked him for something, you know, he had excellent tracking. He'd get it for us if it was real. Uh-oh. If it's real, he could find it. Huh. Gee. So, I go back to Richard Fuse. He said, I didn't tell you to be polite to those people. I told you to, and he ripped me, and I can't say it in a church, ripped me up and down, screaming how I needed to go right back and deliver the message, and I needed to tell the Iraqis the threat originated at the highest level of government above the CIA director and above the Secretary of State. And those were the exact words I was supposed to use. Now, there's only three people who fit that category. The President of the United States, George Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Okay? And they were already alleged, according to my CIA handler, he was emphatic on this point, that he did not want the Iraqis to think that it was his threat or my threat or the CIA's threat. None of the above. He wanted me to know it came from George Bush's office personally. And because of the way that things work, and because I was an asset in a back channel, when I'm told to deliver a message, that's exactly what I do. That is my job. That is my function. Back channel dialogue. Even during sanctions. See, this is the thing. Our back channel was covert on the U.S. side because of the talking heads and the punditry and the general hatred of Saddam, the paranoia of Saddam, and we had to bypass all of that and have a linkage in case there was actually something that needed to be communicated. Because you can't just have frozen communications. There are times, and terrorism is one of those times. And Iraq, again, had superior tracking, worked very well, really great, always helpful, if they had the intelligence. So Saddam's government responded very worried, very friendly. In May of 2001, we were told that if the United States thought there was going to be a terrorism attack involving airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center, we should send the FBI immediately, the FBI task force. The diplomat assured me right there in that meeting, he'd already been authorized to invite the FBI. Baghdad had already done it. He said, look, if you think there's something going on, by all means, send the FBI into our country right now. I can assure you I'll sit down with anybody next week. And I'll prepare the paperwork for them. I'll tell the ambassador we have to do this right away. You just give me their names. Give me the names of the FBI agents. Come on. Do it. I went back to Washington, and I said, well, Richard, you know, here's the answer to their threat. They said, send them on. Come on, let's do it. Bring it. Remember how George Bush liked to say, bring it, baby? The Iraqis said pretty much the same thing. You think there's something here? Bring it. Come on, let's do it. So throughout the summer, we had this weird thing happening where the Iraqis were promising everything you could possibly want. And every time we mention 9/11, they say, send the FBI. Why haven't you done it? We keep telling you to send the FBI. Why don't you do it? Gee, Susan, you know, you keep asking us about this attack, but you realize the United States is the only one talking about it. We're tracing all of the intelligence regarding this attack. All this chatter always goes back to you, meaning the United States. Goes back to Washington. So we were putting out feelers, and these other countries were spinning it back to us. But when the Iraq, but when you do a back trace on where the intelligence was coming from, that the foreign countries were responding to, they were responding to what we were telling them. So it was like circling back. But we were the origination. Do you understand? We were the origin of the intelligence. So, in August of 2001, this continued throughout the summer. In August of 2001, on August 2nd, the Senate held nomination hearings for Robert Mueller to head the FBI. I had a very prescient conversation with my CIA handler, as it turns out. I said, you know, there's never been a terrorism investigation that guy didn't throw. What do you think he'll do now when this new attack occurs? And my CIA handler and I had a rather vicious, catty conversation about how we were convinced Robert Mueller was going to screw up the 9/11 investigation. And I talk about that in my book. It was August 2nd. And Richard Fuse said, oh, Susan, you know, what if there is no FBI director when the attack occurs? And I said to him, you mean you think it's that soon? He said, oh yeah, the attack is imminent. We know that. Well, the attack is imminent. And I said, well, God, Richard, I'll run up to New York and ask the Iraqis if they've got anything. You know, we've been pumping them for information all summer long. We'll see if they've got anything back from Baghdad. He said, oh no, it's too dangerous. Don't go up there. See, we were expecting two things to happen in tandem. We were trained, and this is important because whether it's actually true, whether it's factually true, the intelligence community was prepped in advance to expect airplane hijackings. We were told that was how it was going to go down. Plus, we were also told that there would be a, quote, miniature thermonuclear device that would be used in tandem with the weapon, with the airplane hijackings. And so I remember having conversations saying, well, where are they going to get a nuclear bomb? How are they going to get it on an airplane? How is this going to go down? And we figured out that they could always steal a bomb from one of the, anywhere in driving distance to New York City, because they're not watched over very carefully. None of those munition supplies are watched over very well. And so in July, we're talking about this. And we're talking about a nuclear bomb being used because we're expecting the towers to collapse in a combination of airplane hijackings and some form of explosion. Now, I know that I'm with architects and engineers, and I know that Richard Gage has done a superior job of investigating nanothermite. I defer to his investigation on the type of explosive that was actually used. You don't need to say, oh, Susan Lindauer says it was a nuclear bomb. Before 9/11, we were prepped to expect explosives. That's the point. And in August, by the time I went up to New York on August 4th, which was a Saturday, on August 6th, the Monday, I came back and had a meeting with my CIA handler, and he and I hashed out what we were going to do. Because we're not passive people. I mean, that's one thing about being an asset. You are not passive. We don't just sit on our hands. So we knew there was going to be something going on. We did something about it. At my CIA handler's instructions, I telephoned the office of Attorney General John Ashcroft. Because I was a CIA spooky person with a long history of work in anti-terrorism, I had a phone number for his private office. I want to emphasize, this was not a phone call to the 800 number on the highway, which is a dead letterbox. This was not going off into the ether somewhere floating around the Justice Department. I had the phone number for his private staff. In the case of an emergency, anytime at all, I could use it. And if I couldn't get hold of my, that was why I had it. If I needed to get hold of someone and my handlers were not available, I could call out the Marines if I needed to, call out the FBI. And I used it for 9/11. On August 6th was a Monday. I would say this was August 7th or August 8th. In plenty of time to orchestrate a major response to preempt the 9/11 attack. The private staff, and what I asked for was an emergency broadcast alert through all federal agencies requesting any intelligence on airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center identified specifically. I told them the attack was imminent. We expected mass casualties and a possible miniature thermonuclear device, which we believed would have been stolen from a munitions factory in the United States. So we were not saying it was going to be a foreign bomb. We believed it would be an American bomb used against an American target. And I said, we are looking for any fragment of intelligence. Please make this an emergency priority. We believe the attack is imminent. Respond through all channels. The FBI, Attorney General John Ashcroft's private staff said, gave me a phone number at the Office of Counterterrorism. And they said, repeat what you just told me to those people over there. And I did. And they, I was told later that John Ashcroft's response to my call was, yeah, those darn CIA people, they keep complaining about this threat of this attack, this airplane hijacking, this scenario, they're going to strike the World Trade Center. Yeah, they keep talking about this. But the bureaucrat had already acted to get the information, to get me the phone number for the Office of Counterterrorism. I'd already gone to them. And so the FBI office in Minneapolis sends back a response about the arrest of Moussaoui. Okay? And they send it back through all channels, something that George Bush has never been able to explain. How did the FBI even consider that there would be such an attack? And how is it that they responded to all the Secret Service and FAA and all this stuff? And it was because this was an emergency broadcast alert. When I decided that I was going to, now I'm going to jump ahead. When I decided that I was going to talk, I'll jump now to Carswell and my arrest when I tried to talk. My CIA handler, whom otherwise, other than this, I loved dearly, until this happened, I was heartbroken over this. I think he was heartbroken over it too, but he had a different response than I did. He was offered 13, he was given, not offered, he was given $13 million to shut his mouth. And I'd like to tell you, it is my understanding, and any of you please correct me, that the 9/11 Commission itself got $11 million. And if anybody wants to correct me, that's okay. $11 million to do their investigation. He was paid more money to cover it up and shut up. And I got arrested and thrown in jail. The reason you don't know anything that I've just said tonight, unless you've read my book, Extreme Prejudice, is because when they needed to, their response was to destroy the messenger, shoot the messenger, shoot to kill. I, not Osama bin Laden, I was the biggest threat. Or at least I felt like the biggest threat. They made me feel like the biggest threat. I was accused of something. They decided, they wanted to have it both ways. They decided that I was, though I had done all this work, I was declared incompetent to stand trial. I was essentially, though they testified, and now listen, they testified that they saw no evidence of hallucinations, no evidence of hearing voices, no evidence of depression, no evidence of bipolar disorder. I've never had any of those conditions my entire life. I am very argumentative. I am very ferocious in my opinions, perhaps, but I am not. But even at Carswell, they were forced to, quote, rule out a delusional disorder. Now, the propaganda about me is very different. They tried to make me sound like I was a lunatic. I was this insane Christian mania. I suffered from some kind of religious mania. And I do, you know, and guys, I do believe in God. I do. And if you're atheist, I don't care. It really doesn't affect me. It's only my opinion. It's, you know, it's what makes me happy in my life. And I love the trees. I was telling Jane Milliken on the way over here, you put me in front of a tree and I'm going to be happy. I just love nature and I love the beauty and the magnificence of this earth. So throw me in jail. Which you did. Which they did. But while I was at Carswell, it was the publicly they were attacking me for allegedly being this insane lunatic. But at Carswell, the game that was playing out was, how do we get her to, how do we destroy her knowledge of 9/11? Because by this stage, not only did the U.S. not only did the Attorney General knew it, the FBI knew it, the Office of Counterterrorism knew it, the FBI interviewed my witness, Parker Godfrey, who testified about it. Judge Michael Mukasey, who was my judge, was also hearing Larry Silverstein's insurance claims for the 9/11 case. At the same time, and I would go into court in shackles, pretty much in tears, just shocked out of my mind. For a while I was in Texas, and then at the very end they brought me up to New York. But Larry Silverstein's attorneys would be going out, and I'd be going in. And I'd be like, Your Honor, we knew about 9/11. And they'd say, she's crazy, don't listen to her. But Larry Silverstein got how much money?
$14 billion.
How much?
$14 billion.
$14 billion. That's insurance fraud. He should be forced to return it all. He should be sent to jail. But you can't get these people because they're too big. People like me are little. You can get us, but you can't get him. But I hope he chokes on it someday. Chokes on a dime. He just is a... But I was diagnosed officially with oppositional defiance disorder. And the idea and in a lot of politics that a lot of a diagnosis that frequently mirrors the old Soviet psychiatry. And let me remind you that until Gorbachev fell, 30% of all intellectuals and dissidents who got in trouble in the Soviet Union, from Brezhnev on, and probably from Stalin on, 30% of them were locked up in mental institutions. They were accused of being of sluggish, what the Soviet doctors called sluggish schizophrenia. And they said that on the outside it appeared to be a mild neuroses and there would be no behavioral problems, no behavioral issues. However, the sluggish schizophrenia manifested as a belief in reform delusions. The idea, seriously, the idea that individuals could make a difference to society. The idea that society needed to be changed and could be changed to something better than what it was right now. And they would dope up these people for years. And let me tell you, that's what they wanted to do to me. They actually petitioned the court for the right to detain me for up to 10 years with no trial, because it's a Patriot Act, no trial, no right to a hearing. Now, this was complicated because my public defender didn't know how to deal with my case, so he refused to even ask for a hearing. And I was like, oh, I'm a hearing. He's like, oh, no, we don't want to do that. Oh, gee, can't you just kind of go along with this? So I was like, no, I'm not going to go along with this. And they wanted to drug me with, they actually petitioned the court for the right to forcibly drug me with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac. Though I suffer no depression, they admitted that I suffer no delusional disorder. They had nothing to give the judge. I was not a threat to myself or to anybody else. I was a happy person. Happy person in prison. The records show that I was cooperative, smiling, good eye contact, low-key, no behavioral issues, functioned well on the unit. There was nothing. It wasn't like I was like attacking the guards or I was threatening anybody. I just kept to myself. I stayed with the other prisoners, did not want any confrontations with these people. So even oppositional defiance disorder was kind of difficult to justify because, you know, I wasn't threatening the guards every 5 minutes. I just stayed away from them. I avoided them. But they knew what my politics was, and that was all it took. And that's what it's about now. While I was there, my uncle, my public defender had abandoned me. My uncle, who was an attorney, tried to visit me. And we saw the first of the NDAA. I was locked up on a military base. So when my uncle shows up, who is an attorney, the military base told him that there was no prison on the base, and I was not an inmate there. I was not located on anywhere on their facility. My uncle was quite perplexed by this. He said, I was at the hearing ordering her to go to Carswell. I have letters from the prison. I have the court order documenting her surrender. And what are you talking about? She's not here. How did you move her? How did you do this? You know, he thought that, you know, and then the second time he came, they had a new excuse. And that was that, there was a military base there. Excuse me, there was a prison on the military base, but they had no visiting hours on the weekends. So he wasn't allowed to see me then. Now, he traveled 700 miles in each direction. 1,400 miles round trip. And he liked to drive, he said, because he wanted to think and not have any phone interruptions, because my case was such a headache, such a complex mess, that he just wanted to tune it all out and just focus on driving. He could just think while he was driving. So he drove it. And he said, this is ridiculous. You have to let me into this base. And other inmates' families were going right around him, and they said, you can go in, you can go in. Nope. The Iraqi agent is not getting an attorney's visit. And so the third time he came, he had U.S. Marshals standing by. And literally the way that he forced himself onto the base was that he shamed Judge Mukasey into ordering the U.S. Marshals to stand by, flanking him at the gate. And they said, if you won't let Ted Lindauer onto this base, we're going to take him in over your objections. And this is a precursor to the NDAA. This is how the NDAA is actually going to play out. Because the military operates under a totally different set of rules, and they are not subject to any judicial, you know, ordinarily they're not subjected to any sort of judicial oversight. And so the military commander will decide whether they even acknowledge that there is a prison or whether they allow a prisoner individually to be recognized. You could go back, you could literally lose your relative to a husband, wife, daughter, and never know where they are for years. They don't even have to give you a phone call. They don't have to let you write letters home. I mean, you don't even, I mean, you're not scared enough You aren't. The Department of Homeland Security is already drafting a manual for how to run these darn things. And it's just, and how they're going to separate, how they're going to identify the ringleaders and separate them and put them in solitary confinement, and how they're going to, you play loud music to, or loud noises, like siren sounds 24 hours a day to break the spirit of these people, because we're all activists and we're all, you know, troublemakers, and so we're going to be a little bit difficult. Yep. And we are. We're gonna be trouble. We're trouble for these guys. When I was at Carswell, what the last thing I want to say to you, I think, is really important. Then I'll open this up to questions. I know I've been saying a lot. Hopefully, I've given you a lot of information tonight. But what I'd like to close with this, because you know this is Cambridge, and I know that a lot of you care about racial justice and racial equality, and we take that for granted these days. We presume. But I'll tell you that already the black community is going through a lot of what we're going to go through. They have their own way of treating these people in the prisons, and it is very, very, very ugly. At Carswell, it was very customary for black women to be singled out, especially if they were middle class, educated, literate. The guards would say, guards told me straight up that certain black women read the newspaper. And then shortly after, they were accused of reading newspapers, and I was told not to read a newspaper. This is how it came out. I asked to see a newspaper because I wanted to have something to read and have something to do, look at your current events. And they're like, don't. Do not ask for a newspaper. She asked for a newspaper. Watch what's going to happen to her. I was told not to sit in the little closet with the TV turned on to CNN. They have, in the prison, they have a television set that is designated for news. I was told, do not go in there and turn it on, because it's like a test. And if you go in there and watch, if you watch CNN or Fox News, you're failing a test. And it's scary stuff. It's really that scary that you can't even imagine. But I had a very wonderful, good woman, black woman friend who was declared incompetent, and over her strongest objections, and she was a piano teacher. And you guys can't even believe what they did to this woman. She was a piano teacher, and they asked her what kind of music she taught. And she said, "Why? I teach everything. You know, I she taught children." And they said, "Well, you can teach jazz." I know this is going to be very offensive, and it should be offensive. I'm not justifying. To remember this, it's okay if you teach jazz. It's okay if you teach rhythm and blues. She said, "Well, I do, but I also teach Mozart. I teach Chopin. I can play Tchaikovsky. Sure. You teach white children Mozart?" She had to justify why she had white children in her home as a black woman piano teacher. And she had to fight the same battle that I did, not to be doped up with Haldol, because she was suffering middle class pretensions of being a black person who thought she was going to be like us. What? You must be incompetent if you think that. I mean, you think the racism, it's so... I was never one for Al Sharpton until I got to Carswell. And then I saw, where is Jesse Jackson? I remember weeping like in terrified fear, really afraid, really, really scared out of my mind, just like... You know, I'd go in the showers because that was the only place you could ever be alone. And I'd hear what they were doing to these women right in the shower stalls next to us. And these women could no longer bathe themselves. So they'd have to be stripped naked by the guards or other inmates and physically washed, because they couldn't. They'd have to get a chair to sit them down because they couldn't stand up anymore. So these women would be bathed, but they'd have to sit down. And then they'd, you know, it was just grotesque. It was really a grotesque thing. They could not walk. They could not speak. They could not carry a chair into the bathroom. We actually had big arguments over, you know, I remember being really ripped to shreds because I took a chair out of a bathroom once. And it turned out it was one of the women, one of the black women who had been reading a newspaper. Reading a newspaper. And they taught her a lesson. They cured her literacy problem. I used to write letters home for her after that. When I would write to her family and she'd sit there and she'd grunt. She couldn't even speak anymore. And tears would just stream down her face. But she could. But they did not. They do not want women, black women, to be empowered. And these were active. These were women who were more within the black community. They would be considered activists. Not. They're not like, you know, Black Panther activists. But they just believe in human rights. They believe in racial justice. They'd probably be part of ANSWER. You know ANSWER? Okay. They'd be like, I try to think of like, you know, a type of actress, because we can all identify actresses. I would say kind of like Jennifer Hudson. She'd be a real threat at Carswell. Whoa. Jennifer Hudson. No, you can't have that kind of stuff. And so this is about conditioning people to stop achieving anything. I mean, it is a punishment for strong, confident, motivated women. And what you should be afraid about, and this is something that you should care about, because political activists, regardless of race, a lot of white political activists, are ending up at Carswell. And that's the prison of choice. If you're a tax resister, if you are a free speech activist, when I was there, right before I got there, there was another woman who'd from Virginia who published a couple of articles in a weekly newspaper. And the weekly newspaper wasn't even breaking the law. It wasn't a violent speech, but she criticized George Bush. She criticized the politics of the state of Virginia, and they just picked her up and took her, like that Brendan Raub, R-A-U-B, who was picked up and taken to a mental institution. He was a veteran who was held because he posted something on Facebook, and they forced him to be released. Well, this lady didn't have anybody on her side. She was there for 4 years, and they doped her up like crazy to punish these people. So, I mean, you know, chances are if you're a woman and an activist, plowshares activists go there all the time. Plowshares activists. I mean, if you have any sort of political voice, they want you behind bars on a military base because the military base can stop the media from entering the prison to see you. And so I just want to say, I mean, for all my women friends at Carswell this is just sort of for them because I was not the only one who was getting targeted, but I was the only one who really escaped it because I fought back and I had a public voice to speak with. But the abuses are hideous, and it's ongoing. And it's an unforgivable thing when you see it.
In a moment,